You are listening to ABC Radio National Saturday Extra with me, Nick Bryant. Now to our America at 250 series, which is fast reaching its climax. Next Saturday is July the 4th, a big birthday itself, and we've got a lot lined up already for that. But this week, we're discussing race in America.
We shall overcome.
I have a dream that one day, this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
Why does it look like it might be the year of the ballot or the bullet? Because Negroes have listened to the trickery and the lies and the false promises of the white man now for too long, and they're fed up.
Because we have tasted the bitter swill of civil war and segregation and emerged from that dark chapter stronger and more united, we cannot help but believe that the old hatreds shall someday pass.
That was the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., of course, Malcolm X, and Barack Obama. And I've been talking to another of America's leading black voices, Shelby Steele, a child of the Civil Rights Revolution, a black radical in the late 1960s, and a figure who emerged as a prominent black conservative in more recent decades, fiercely opposed to policies such as affirmative action. Shelby Steele celebrated his 80th birthday earlier this year. As we'll hear, he was born into a segregated country. Shelby Steele, thank you so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Well, thank you for having me.
July the 4th marks the adoption of the Declaration of Independence, and it includes those ringing words, doesn't it? All men are created equal and possess the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I wonder, what did those words signify for black Americans at the beginning, at the outset of the American Republic?
Yes, I don't think they meant very much. Slavery was still in place, firmly in place at that point in American history. Blacks were entirely segregated and separated from the mainstream of American life. But at least with the Declaration of Independence, there was a reach for something more. I imagine that some blacks were probably happy to see that document come along. But it was not as radical then as it was in the 1960s when Martin Luther King uttered those words at the March on Washington.
He called it a promissory note, didn't he? And in the struggle for black equality that emerged, especially after World War II, the Declaration of Independence really did come to mean something. African Americans wanted to make real that promise.
Yes, I grew up with that sort of promise. My parents were married in the civil rights movement. They were founding members of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality. Our life was pretty much consumed in the 1950s in the struggle for civil rights, which was a novelty. It was a different thing in mainstream America at that point in time. I sort of was blessed, I guess. I didn't know that at the time. Wasn't always comfortable to be identified that way. But I also grew up with a sense that phrase, all men are created equal, was my best hope for a bigger life than first seemed to be promised.
You have a fascinating perspective. Your mother was white, your father was black, and literally your birth story tells us about the America that you were born into, of how segregation separated the races from the cradle to the grave. For those that don't know your origin story, tell us what it was. That hospital, for instance, where you were born.
The hospital was segregated, as most hospitals were in those days. My mother was wheeled into the hospital and my father was at her side. They presumed that my father was her caretaker. And they took her immediately to the upper floor, fifth floor, I think it was, of the hospital, where she was prepared for delivery. After, I guess, a very short time, maybe 10, 20 minutes, somehow the hospital got word that a black was about to be born in this hospital. the hospital went a little crazy. They wrapped her up in blankets, put her on a bed, and rolled her down to the elevator to the basement where blacks were born. All black deliveries were in the basement at that time, and obviously it was an inferior sort of location, and you didn't always have your needs met. They resented having blacks anywhere near their hospital. And so I was born there. My mother was an extraordinary woman, very courageous. She had her child. She became friends with all the other black women in the black ward. They began to form a little political group. Things progressed to the point where ultimately, 20 years later, segregation ceased, at least in any obvious formal way. It was a long time, however, before we got to the place where Chicago was open enough to allow black children to be born in white hospitals.
The mid-60s see the great civil rights reforms, don't they? The 1964 Civil Rights Act. It kills off Jim Crow, that system of racial apartheid into which you were born. The 1965 Voting Rights Act brings about genuine universal suffrage. For the first time, really, in U.S. history, blacks in the South especially have been prevented from voting.
Yeah.
But a theme of your writing is that was actually the point. That moment of great success and achievement, those landmark reforms, that was the point where things started to go awry for many black Americans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why so?
We got to a point where we just simply couldn't take it anymore. I remember that very distinctly as I went through high school. I was exposed to bigger ideas. Malcolm X was and remains, in my view, an important figure for me because he said, your freedom is by any means necessary. You may have to fight, you may have to die, but you must be free. And anything you do in the interim, you're tolerating the evil that persecutes you. Well, to an 18-year-old kid, already a little wired up, this was music to my ears. Like many others in my generation, I became radical, and I moved into a sort of identity that was focused on revolting against racism at any price. And I can remember that during King's era of civil rights, everybody wore suits and ties when they went to a demonstration. By 64, 65, 66, that was over with. We began to dress in African clothes. We took our own style seriously. We began to move into the era that I call black power. We demanded power. And we began to be rebellious in society. And in order to approve your credentials, your identity as a black, you had to show a capacity for tolerating violence no matter the cost.
I'm Nick Bryant. This is Saturday Extra. As part of our America at 250 series, I'm speaking with Shelby Steele, an African-American historian and one of the country's foremost public intellectuals. Shelby Steele, you were talking there about how you got swept up in the radicalism of the late 1960s. In more recent decades, you've become one of the leading black conservatives in the United States. Describe that transition from the radical of the late 60s to a conservative figure who emerged in the 80s and the 90s.
Through the early 70s, I was Mr. Black Power. I was radical. Well, life is, I guess, does that. If you live long enough, you come to a place where you're dead wrong. And I came to that place in college and in graduate school. You get into, I certainly did, I'll speak for myself, got in touch with a certain anger that was insatiable and bigger than me, bigger than myself. I came to the place where I began to feel that this whole thing of going along with a civil rights movement, it was destructive to the people who gave vent to it as well as their victims, as well as their targets. I began to see that violence in America was not the best way.
Shelby Still, you've written that after the reforms of the civil rights era, African Americans entered into what you call a Faustian pact by placing their destiny in the hands of contrite white people, and that left blacks pleading with government, not for freedom, which had already been won, but for programs and preferences that would be a ladder to full equality. Your sense was that the great civil rights reforms had actually given African Americans all they needed. They did not need any additional assistance from the federal government.
Yes, it introduced a second era of oppression, really, of blacks. White America, out of what I consider to be courage, that having confessed, as they did in the 60s, to racism, they now needed redemption. In other words, what Martin Luther King did was a deep and profound thing. He established in American life the idea that racism is immoral, is an immorality, is an evil, and that it will never, under any circumstances, be something that will build and develop a people. Whites now had no grounds to deny that. They had to take it. 300, 400 years of oppressing a people, you got a bill to pay. You've trafficked in evil to people who did nothing to you. That is the core of race relations in America today, and it was the core 400 years ago. Well, now in the 60s, whites did this heroic thing of admitting it's wrong and setting out looking for redemption in order to have moral authority in their own society. America would be illegitimate if it could not confess to evil and then begin to do something about it. Well, it was the do something about it part that problematic. When you start to build apartment buildings that you put blacks in because they were victimized in the past and have no housing of any sort. When you change their schools around to reflect an ideology of radicalism, you say, you can get your redemption by giving me things, by paying off your debt, by reparations. So that is a tremendous tension within a society when you have two groups like that facing each other. Day in, day out, competing for the same college admissions programs. In other words, pretending that there was no segregation, there was no problem. And even if there was, most whites would say, I had nothing to do with it. I've never disliked blacks. I've never had a bone to pick. I am the number one goal of white life in America. I am innocent.
Race has been called the American dilemma. It's been called the American paradox of how a country founded with a noble aim of liberty and freedom also allowed slavery to persist for so long. Bill Clinton once called race America's constant curse. I wonder how much it animates American life.
Oh, liberalism in America is that. It's precisely the... We use race now in employment more than we ever did. We have affirmative action programs, racial preference programs, school curriculum that have been changed around to basically be models of protest. White America took up black suffering as a cause. White America is faced with the challenge of living without innocence, with this vulnerability that they were a part of evil. We don't usually say this. And I get the same reaction when I was 18, the same when I'm 48, whatever. President Johnson in 1965 gave us the Civil Rights Bill and so forth. All of those pieces of legislation, the claim was they were going to bring redemption to whites, because they were going to give whites a chance to show goodwill toward black people, to be apologetic even toward black people. That is how we whites would in a sense restore their innocence, their sense of decency, and proof that they were no longer the racist whites that they had been for so many centuries.
And your argument would be that that mindset has been harmful for African Americans.
Yes, it is. It's the worst thing that could be. We would have been better off, in my opinion, had whites just simply learned to be civilized and polite and helpful when, and live like everybody else in America. That's what we needed. We didn't need somebody saying, we're going to give you 100 extra points on your SAT exam. Because what it does is it says, when you start to give blacks things to redeem whites, you're basically giving blacks the same old inferiority that they were charged with to begin with by the racists. So today, black people are more dependent than they were in the days of segregation.
You mentioned Lyndon Johnson there. He said something in 1965, which I think is worth quoting, a speech at Howard University, the African-American University in Washington, D.C. "You do not take a person who for years has been hobbled by chains and liberate him, bring him up to the starting line of a race, and then say, you're free to compete with all the others and still justly believe that you have been completely fair." I mean, that sentiment still animates a lot of...
Yes, it does.
A lot of attitudes towards race, and you reject that.
That point of view steals from me as a black my agency over my own life. And you take up people who've already been brutalized for centuries and can try to convince them that they're not free if they're not getting guilt money from the white man.
I wonder what it says about America that the country's first African-American president, Barack Obama, was followed into office by Donald Trump, who rose to political prominence as the untitled leader of the birther movement, which rejected the very legitimacy of the country's first African-American president.
Tells us the country struggles with race and from day to day doesn't quite know what to make of it. When they hear me talk about and say that you are oppressing black people today more than you did in the segregation era, they go apoplectic because they had based their claim on innocence on giving blacks some kind of reparation.
And do you think Donald Trump is more representative of America than many people would care to think?
Yeah, yeah.
When he goes up against DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, does that endure your support?
Oh, my God, yes. Even Donald Trump cannot say it strong enough for me. I have 5 grandchildren. Those grandchildren are now beginning to apply to universities. They have to compete against other kids, obviously, white, black, and otherwise. They're bright. They're hardworking. Why would you give them a program of government money? The point is not them. Again, the point is... you would give them money in order to gain your own innocence.
The argument would be that your grandchildren don't need help. They are members of a prosperous black middle class. It's African Americans in the parts of America that aren't prosperous. It's African Americans who've been left behind in the economy. What about...
And how should they get out of that? Join another program? Another reading, teaching, DEI sort of deal? Is that how they should do it? Or should they study a little harder? Compete with whites, with everybody else. Stand up like men and women, at last willing to take a risk on oneself, on your own ability to work and think and write and so forth. You keep us locked into inferiority so that you as whites might feel innocent about your racial views. How long can a society bear up under that conflict? Blacks in this are murdering people day in and day out.
Shelby Steele, you have brought a perspective from Black America that, frankly, we don't often hear. And I've enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Well, I've enjoyed the conversation as well. Thank you for having me.
That was Shelby Steele, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and the author of many books, including White Guilt, How Blacks and Whites together destroyed the promise of the civil rights era.